This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon, I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up today, we'll find out more about a very special group of students, foster kids from across Indiana, who are going to be coming into Purdue University Northwest this weekend to participate in what is called the Summer Bridge Program. We'll talk with Stephanie Poe about that. She is with Connect Indiana Connected by 25. We'll also find out more about two of the upcoming series of Indiana Black Legislative Caucus meetings. Another one is planned for this summer in Gary. And we'll also find out two more about the special celebration to note the 50th anniversary of Richard Hatcher's being elected as Gary's mayor. A group of about 50 Indiana foster youth are going to be coming to Purdue University Northwest Hammond campus beginning this weekend to begin several weeks in what is called the Summer Bridge Program. It's being put on by Indiana Connected by 25. We'll find out more about the organization and more about the event coming up here. I'm talking with the Director of Education Strategies for Indiana Connected by 25, Stephanie Poe. Stephanie, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Take a moment, if you will, and tell us a little bit about what Indiana Connected by 25 is and why opportunities like the Indiana Bridge Program that is going to be happening this week or starting this week is so important.
Yes, Indiana Connected by 25 is a foster care agent organization, and we work with foster youth that are being emancipated from the child welfare system, ages 14 to 25. And this program was developed out of several years of a study looking at what are those needs our foster youth have when they are leaving the foster care system. So Indiana Connected by 25 was launched by United Way in 2008, and in 2013, we were able to, what we call, get our own sea legs, become a 501(c) agency, and launch our program. We work in seven core areas: education, housing, financial literacy, youth engagement, health, mental health, their child welfare issues. But we try to build programs in all of those seven core issues that our foster youth experience when leaving the foster care system.
If you will, tell people what the situation is like here in Indiana as far as foster care is concerned. They're not youngsters that you may know, youngsters or know of youngsters who are in foster care, but not the average Hoosier probably doesn't realize that they are out there, and there are so many of them out there. Tell us about how many foster care managed youths are out there, as well as what they're doing and how they're being cared for.
In Indiana, we have several foster youth that are emancipated out of the system every year. For this year, I think we're about 200 to 300 youth that are going to be emancipated. Mm-hmm. One thing that our state has done through the Foster Connections Act of 2008, foster care has been extended to age 20. So a lot of these youth that would leave the Department of Child Services at the age of 18 will now stay till age 20. So our state has become a champion when looking at what can be done to help these youth have a successful future. So the Department of Child Services has committed themselves to working with these youth past the age of 18 and offering services. And Indiana Connected by 25 is one of those agencies that they partner with. And we operate the ETV program, which is the Education Training Voucher Program, that supports foster youth that are going off to post-secondary education, which could be a certificate, a two-year degree or a four-year degree, that we work with them from the time they enter college up until age 23 to support them financially as well as academically.
Now, you mentioned that Indiana Connected by 25 deals with helping to get Indiana foster youth on their own when they get old enough to be able to be able to be on their own, leave foster care and leave the families and go out there and try and make a go in their life. It was probably pretty exciting to come up with this initial Summer Bridge program. The concept behind it is very interesting. Tell us about it and what some of the young people, if not all of the young people, that are going to be participating in the program up here in Hammond are going to be doing.
With this initiative, we last year was able to offer a Summer Bridge program 2 weeks on the campus of Ivy Tech Community College in Indianapolis, and we had the opportunity through a champion with Purdue Northwest University, Dr. Roy Hamilton, that worked with us on getting this Summer Bridge to be 8 weeks on the Purdue Northwest campus. The youth, we are excited to be able to offer this program for our youth, but we are trying our best to make sure the foster youth that are going off to post-secondary education have success in academics, that they reach graduation, and they have a support system around them within the academic community as well as the child welfare community to work with them and support them. The Summer Bridge, we are going to be able to offer each youth up to 6 credits of college credit that will go towards their fall 2017 semester. They will also receive the experience of living on in a dorm and living on the campus, as well as the unique parts that go along with our foster youth, with understanding some of those barriers that prevent them from being successful when they start college. We'll be working with how to deal with family relationships, how to build relationships, conflict resolution. We will also be working on communication, understanding that your professor is not your high school teacher. So there is an array of subjects that they are going to participate in and learn and grow. And we also will be doing some cultural outings, which we are so excited about. We will be attending a lot of the festivals that are going to be in Lake County area, as well as going into Chicago to the Sears Tower, Navy Pier. But we want to give them a full rounded summer bridge that enhances the physical, the emotional, the academic, the mental, and prepare these youth for a successful fall 2017, that they have the tools needed to graduate post-secondary education.
That's great. That's great. We're talking with Stephanie Pope, who is the Director of Education Strategies for an organization that is called Indiana Connected by 25s. And Indiana Connected by 25s is putting out its Summer Bridge program on the Purdue University Northwest campus in Hammond, starting this weekend and continuing for the next 8 weeks. They have a lot of interesting things that they seem to be doing, Stephanie. And you mentioned in part as well, too, the opportunity to see what campus life is like. It's kind of quiet at the Hammond campus during the summer months typically, but sounds like you have enough things going on that certainly they're going to at least get a taste of what it's like to live certainly away from home for at least a few weeks, as well as what it's like when they are able to go to college and have to spend time in the residence hall on campus. What kind of things can you do to prepare these young people for what is going to come up during the summer months?
One thing that we are doing is getting them prepared with the dorm kit. Each youth is going to receive a dorm kit that covers them from the bedding to their bathroom items that they need for the restroom. Everything that a youth needs to pack for the dorm, the youth will receive that when they come onto campus. We will also be helping with their computer. They will receive a computer package and also learn some of those computer skills that are essential when they are on the campus in fall. So this is kind of the time to learn those things or to build where they have gaps, to fill in those gaps to help them be successful. We, Purdue Northwest, has selected professors that are going to work with them, and they understand our foster care population, and they will work with them. We'll have tutoring support. So we're trying to make sure that we give them an ideal academic experience on the campus. So when they get on the campus, wherever they go, because this is a statewide program, some of the youth will be attending Purdue Northwest, some will be at IUPUI, some will be at Ball State, Indiana University. But we are trying to make sure they are equipped for a successful fall 2017 and those academic years that will follow.
Well, it certainly seems that if they get a chance to see what life is like at Purdue Northwest during the summer months, that they'll be ready to go if they end up going to Muncie or to Bloomington or Fort Wayne or wherever it may be, or Indianapolis campuses to go to their first semesters of college. They'll certainly be prepared for that. Tell us, if you will, a little bit about some of these young people that are going to be participating in the Summer Bridge program. These are, I guess you could say, they're kind of like, I hesitate to say the cream of the crop, but these are very well-adjusted students, young people who are ready to go on in life beyond their foster care. But just because they're in foster care, they probably have come in with some baggage, don't they? Tell us about these young people who are going to be coming up here and what you hope that they can take away from spending time here on campus.
We'll start with some of the academic issues that some of the youth may have, or concerns or challenges. We are able to offer 2 tracks while they are on the Purdue Northwest campus. Mm-hmm. We have some of our youth that will be taking courses on the Purdue Northwest campus with Purdue professors. We have some of our youth that will be on the Ivy Tech track, and those Ivy Tech professors will come over to the Purdue Northwest campus and teach those classes. We're trying to best work with our youth best on how to prepare them that have not been prepared for the rigors of college, how to get their study skills brought up to speed, their computer literacy where it needs to be. So some of the youth, we have male, we have female, we have some youth that are 3 to 3.9 GPAs all the way to a 1.1 GPA.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of diversity in this group. We are looking forward to this diversity, and we are championing ourselves to make sure these youth come out ahead and ready for success.
Now, once you get this program taken care of, the 8 weeks finish up here at the Purdue Northwest campus in Hammond, and this first Summer Bridge program officially gets underway. As you said, you had before an opportunity with the Ivy Tech in the past to be able to give them some experience. How do you hope that to be able to follow through just another of the series to continue on, or are you expanding the program, so to speak, to include some other things in the future?
In the future, we have already secured commitment from Purdue Northwest to offer Summer Bridge 2018. And Dr. Marlon Mitchell, that works as the president of the Ivy Tech Gary campus, mm-hmm. has been really crucial in helping our youth and working with Dr. Roy Hamilton. So we are able to offer this Summer Bridge program already in 2018 for the graduating class that will be coming into college fall 2018. So we're excited about that opportunity. We will be having a design studios where Annie E. Casey in the Jobs for the Future will be coming in. They are also funders of this program and offer technical support. They will be coming in August to study the program, bringing in people around the state to look at how we were able to implement this program and lessons learned so that they can go back to the various states and implement a Summer Bridge program.
Well, that's great, because you need some kind of debriefing, I guess, after the event happens and see how things went. What you can do better in 2018 in this case, what the best things that have happened and how to continue those on in the years ahead, too. So it sounds like a lot of exciting things are going to happen with this program in the future. We've been talking with Stephanie Pope, who is the Director of Education Strategies for Indiana Connected by 25. It's an organization that is going to bring a group of about 50 Hoosier foster youngsters in from across the state to the Purdue University Northwest campus in Hammond for about 8 weeks here for what is being called the Summer Bridge Program, an opportunity to get these young people who are different walks of life and different educational levels, all doing well, though, because they want to go on to college and get them acclimated to what life is going to be like when they do start college in earnest, hopefully in the fall of 2017. Stephanie, thank you very much for being with us to talk about the program. The best of luck to you and to all the students that are coming over here, and I hope they enjoy their stay in Northwest Indiana, in particular, a chance to take a look at the region and enjoy some time visiting places in Chicago that you have on the itinerary. So they're going to be very busy young people for the next 8 weeks, it sounds like.
Yes, thank you.
Members of the Black Indiana Legislative Caucus will kick off a series of meetings later this month that are aimed in part at convincing Hoosiers that similar issues affect rural and urban areas of the state. And according to a caucus member and Indianapolis Democratic State Representative Robin Shackelford, these meetings are a way to go across the state as well, too.
We're talking about things that would benefit everyone, that are good for everyone, that the conservative side actually authored a lot of this legislation.
Caucus Chair Sharisa Pryor also represents Indianapolis in the Indiana House and says that there will also be some issues that involve measures such as bills that didn't pass in this past legislative session, but hopes that the caucus is going to take up and will pass in the future.
There are a lot of people that want to pass hate crimes legislation. Unfortunately, there's some people that don't want to see hate crimes legislation passed at all, but I think the town hall does give us an opportunity to talk about that particular issue.
Pryor says that the meetings also serve as a recruitment venue for the group because all of the General Assembly's African-American members come from Lake, Marion, and St. Joseph counties.
As a Black caucus, the one thing that we do recognize is even though we only have African-American members in three cities in the state of Indiana, we have to look out for minority communities and the low-income and disabled community throughout the state of Indiana.
The town halls will begin on June 17th in Indianapolis, and they will wrap up on August 19th at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. The city of Gary is known for a number of things, but in particular for being the Steel City and, as well, the place where the nation's first Black mayor took office. The commemoration of that event 50 years ago this year will be the focus of a major celebration in November. And our Stephen Lattimore has more on what Richard Hatcher's election to be Gary mayor meant back then and today.
The celebration marking the 50th anniversary of the election of the nation's first black mayor, Richard Gordon Hatcher, will be a day to remember. The November 4th celebration will be a fundraiser for Mayor Hatcher's project, the Civil Rights Hall of Fame. His daughter, Councilwoman Reagan Hatcher, says she didn't realize what a big deal her dad's accomplishment was.
Growing up in our house, dad was just dad. You know, he wasn't a national figure. He wasn't the mayor of Gary. He wasn't kind of an icon. He was just dad. And it wasn't until I was probably in middle school until I realized just how significant his election was in 1967 and the impact that he had on the rest of the country.
Current Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson says she followed Mayor Hatcher from a very young age, and he helped shape her career.
I remember as a seven-year-old, my mother having a house party. And Virgie and so many others know that my mother was very active in the community. And at that house party was a man who was at that time a candidate for mayor. And I remember two things. One, that he looked like me. And two, that he was very interested in the citizenship certificate that I had and signed the certificate. And so you can imagine my excitement on election night in November because I got a chance to stay up past my bedtime. And there was a call. And I remember that call because it was on an old rotary phone where my mother got the news that Mayor Hatcher had been successful in the general election. He heard in 1978 that I had made a decision to go to General Motors Institute as opposed to Harvard University. And he called me in and said, I want you to talk to somebody. He didn't say that was a stupid idea or anything like that. He just said, I need you to talk to somebody and just rethink that. And it wasn't just that he did it for me or his family. He did it for generations of young people. It is a tremendous honor to celebrate this, his election, what he meant in this community, and to also celebrate what he has meant for generations of mayors who have gone after him.
The celebration will include Ambassador Andrew Young, former New Orleans Mayor Mark Morial, whose father, Dutch Morial, was also mayor of New Orleans. Reverend Sharpton and Reverend Jackson will also play a role in the commemoration. Reverend Jeanette Wilson is with Operation Push.
If you look at Selma and the Voting Rights Act, Gary was the implementation of our right to vote in the North. And so you are very special to us. Mayor Hatcher is extremely special to our organization and certainly to our founder.
Lamar Taylor, chairman of the board of the National Civil Rights Hall of Fame, says Mayor Hatcher's win meant a new era for African-American political leadership nationwide.
Because as the year 1967 and what happened as a result of that, I think that when we look at Newark, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey said, if Gary can do it, we can do it. Atlanta, Georgia said, if Gary can do it, we can do it. Chicago, Illinois said, if Gary can do it, Harold Washington can do it. Throughout this country, Gary, Indiana, played a major impact on what happened. Even when President Obama thought about running for president, he said, yes, we can. They did it in Gary, Indiana.
In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Top students battle it out every year for one title, valedictorian. And now high schools across the Hoosier State are planning on rethinking that school ranking. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen visits one school that hopes to change the game.
We all have goals. They're dreams with deadlines. And for Thomas Nattinger, that deadline is this year, his senior year of high school.
I've always wanted to get to the valedictorian spot.
At Charlestown High School in southern Indiana, he works hard, real hard. Nattinger is a straight-A student and does a lot with music. He's been in marching band since eighth grade.
And I started actually going to graduations. I had to play the tuba with the band. And so I was understanding the role of valedictorian and what they did.
He saw himself in that role.
So I was thinking in my head, I want to get that.
So he put in work, even traveled to other schools to take specific classes. By senior year, it looked like he'd get valedictorian, too. A self-proclaimed math lover, Nattinger was crushing school. But then...
there was a little bit of trouble at the beginning of the year because there was a deal with three people being in the line for valedictorian.
We were faced with this dilemma of how do you make sure that the student who has taken the most difficult coursework ends up being your valedictorian.
Lori Stinson is a counselor at Charlestown High School. She says it's become an annual problem to name a valedictorian.
People think that that is a simple designation. It is much more complicated than that.
Like many districts across Indiana, Charlestown has weighted grade point averages. Classes like APs carry more heft. That's in part to encourage students to take hard classes instead of fearing a bad grade could ruin their GPA.
Our plan of encouraging students to pursue harder level coursework, that part was still working, but the valedictorian recognition wasn't.
Think about it. Classes with different weights, study halls, honors classes versus AP classes. Ranking students gets messy. In fact, this year, counselors docked a credit from someone who had a high GPA but hadn't taken the hardest classes. And that put Nattinger, the student from earlier, in that valedictorian spot.
Once I finally got there, it was like, yes, I made it.
But Counselor Stinson says the system doesn't work for everyone. Over the years, she's seen
students who were trying to manipulate their course choices so that they could be valedictorian and not making course choices that were best for their planned career.
Did you have kids who were saying, I'm trying to get this title, so I am going to change up what I'm taking?
Absolutely. Well, and they also want us to try to feed them, well, what is so-and-so taking? Well, that's not healthy either.
So district officials came up with a new system.
Cum laude, magna cum laude, and summa cum laude in there. It's determined by grade point average.
Steve Griffin is assistant superintendent for the whole district here at Greater Clark County Schools. He says if you make above a certain GPA, you'll get an honor. Griffin hopes the laude system promotes collaboration.
It diminishes the unhealthy competition because if I come in third place out of 500 students, I shouldn't feel like a failure. I had a great high school career.
And it's not just Indiana schools embracing change. That trend is national, too. Colleges recognize that. They give more weight to student course loads, extracurriculars. Greater Clark County Schools will adopt the new model in 2020.
The valedictorian and salutatorian had a great run. In today's current society, I really feel like the laude system is a more appropriate and fair system for students.
New system, but same deadline, senior year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. What is the truth? That's the question posed by Counterpoint host Gerard McClendon to his guests, attorney Dr. Stanley Robertson, Valparaiso University professor Aaron Preston, and comedian Damon Williams.
I've been thinking about this question for maybe the last 6 months. What is true? I've gone to college. I've gone to seminars. I've talked to my friends. Nobody could come up with a good qualitative or quantitative answer on what truth is. So, gentlemen, I had to have the three of you in today, a college professor, a lawyer and author, and, of course, I had to bring in Damon Williams, the comedian, for some good comedic value to figure this question out. So I'm going to start with you, Stanley Robertson. What is the truth to an author and a lawyer? What is truth?
Yeah, there's really no such thing as truth. However, at the same time, truth is everything. Mm-hmm. So in other words, truth is very elusive. I don't think you can actually define truth because truth is really a function of your personal perspective.
So you think truth is relative?
Very much so.
Okay, so then why even have a truth if it's just relative?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. Because if I look at truth, it depends on where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. If I'm thinking about truth, for example, in my profession, let's just say hypothetically speaking, if I'm mm-hmm. thinking about the truth from the standpoint of teaching college,
okay.
If I'm looking at truth from the standpoint of doing corporate tax, or if I'm looking at truth from a religious perspective, all those things, the truth is different.
It's different. Okay, before I go to the professor and the comedian, straw man concept. What is that? I know you've written a book on straw man fallacy,
right.
But what is the straw man? Then we're going to get to the professor.
Right. The book is called The Straw Man Fallacy. Mm-hmm. A straw man is a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. So when you make an argument, obviously you have to have certain elements of that argument. The straw man is a fallacy which says that your argument is faulty. There's something wrong with what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's wrong with what you just said is that you took my argument, you restated my argument in a weaker position,
yeah.
And then you refuted the restatement, not yeah. the original argument.
In program evaluation, we call them type 1 and type 2 errors. And so we're going to come back to straw man a little bit later. Professor Aaron Preston, is there some such thing as truth? What is truth?
Well, there are a number of perspectives on truth in the history of philosophy, and one of them is the view that Stanley just articulated a moment ago, this relativistic view on truth. But the more dominant view of truth in the Western tradition, at least, is what's called the correspondence theory, which says that truth is a matter of correspondence to reality or accuracy of representation.
Mm.
So that, for instance, if you have a belief or make a statement to the effect that there are four mugs on the table, that's going to be true if there are four mugs on the table. And if there are not four mugs on the table, it's going to be false.
Mm-hmm.
So on my view, since I subscribe to the correspondence theory, I do think there is such a thing as truth. I don't think it's just a matter of personal opinion or preference.
Does it have to be verified by more than one source, or can one person hold the truth without two or three others verifying it?
Well,
does the truth just stand on its own?
The truth stands on its own. And see, there's an important distinction to be made from a philosophical perspective between the truth and our knowledge of the truth. Our knowledge of the truth requires evidence. If we make a claim that isn't backed up by evidence, it's not clear that we have a right to be very confident in that claim. It might be true just by accident, but we're still not going to think of it as a very respectable claim.
Hold tight. I want to get to Damon. Hold on tight to the comment because I got to get Damon in here.
All right.
Damon,
yes.
I've seen your show.
Okay.
It's spectacular.
Thank you.
And a lot of it has to do with you telling the truth. What is the truth, Damon Williams? And why does a comedian have to tell truth or truths to be successful?
Well, actually, there's a conflict there because the old heads called comedy telling lies. So in truth, of course, there's truth to the story, but there's also fiction inside our truth. Now, there are different variations of truth as far as I'm concerned, because I want to be true to myself when I perform, because if I'm inauthentic, then I'm not performing it in my real truth. And then when I'm really doing my job well, they'll call me the truth.
Oh,
like,
wow.
That dude is the truth.
The truth.
You get it? So truth does have different, variations within the comedic realm.
Yeah, much what the professor said.
Right.
So is a relativity involved? There's a semantic element of, man, Damon is the truth.
Right.
Or let's say,
when the whole time I could be lying.
You could be lying. Absolutely. Professor Aaron Preston is the truth. He's, you know, written tons of articles.
Indeed.
Or, you know, the lawyer and author Stanley Robertson is the truth. He's written several books. And so we're coming up with a construct of truth. Stanley, you had a comment to make a little bit earlier.
I was just going to say that I was having a conversation with some kids some time ago. There was three kids. We were talking about truth.
Mm-hmm.
We had read a book. In the book, one of the characters was lying, and we were having a discussion about that. One of the kids said, when I asked him what is the truth? What's going on with this particular character? He said, well, the truth is relative. He didn't use the word relative, but the truth is relative. And then he said that, for example, if my mom asked me, did you eat that peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, no, I had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with bologna.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, I had a bologna sandwich. Mm-hmm. It just happened to have peanut butter and jelly on it.
Mm-hmm.
So for that kid, the truth His mother wanted to know, did you eat the peanut butter and jelly?
Oh, so go ahead.
The mother's truth is he did eat the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The kid's truth is no, it was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but with bologna.
So there were levels that the two speakers had to come to some sort of correspondence and agreement on. The mother had a concept. The child had a concept. Were both of them expressing the truth?
Yes.
What do you think, Professor?
Well, I'm friendly to the idea that both of them were telling the truth. You know, at some level, there's a common reality out there. There are differences in the ways in which we describe them, and those differences of description can oftentimes lead us to talk past each other. I don't want to say that this means there are different truths for different speakers. It just means we need to do more work to understand each other.
And I'd like to say, in my household, Mama told the truth, and the son was in trouble. The peanut butter and the jelly is missing. I don't care what you put with it, bologna, bread, toast, crackers. Did you eat the peanut butter and jelly? So, yes.
So, Mama was judge and jury.
Right.
And it didn't make a difference.
Indeed.
With the
in my household, not in the academic realm here.
Okay. So, let's talk about aesthetic quality, all right? All of us have on what I would deem to be true, that these are nice clothes that we have on, but it's relative, right? We enter into a different culture. These clothes may be looked upon as being raggedy or being looked upon as being uppity, all right? So it depends on the situation. But does truth have an aesthetic? I'm putting on my professor hat now. So when we look at the axiology of it, how do we qualitatively value things? So we can look at them from an aesthetic point of view. It's a beautiful cup. That's a beautiful pair of glasses. We can also look at them aesthetically, and we can look at them ethically. Does the cup fulfill its purpose? You see what I'm saying?
I think that if you look at the truth from an aesthetic point of view, as you described, when you think about the truth, there you have to make a distinction between an opinion and a fact. If something is a fact, then we may judge that fact as being true or false. Mm-hmm. If something is an opinion, the opinion is not true or false. So if you say, you know, that's a nice suit that you have on, that's your opinion, then you can't judge that opinion to be true or false.
Aesthetically, we can't judge it.
No, I don't think so.
So when someone says that's a handsome man or that's a beautiful woman, they can't qualitatively value beauty? It's only beautiful to them?
Yeah, it's subjective. That to that person,
come on, Stanley.
You can be
come on, Stanley.
Beautiful.
There are some women out there, 99 out of 100 men might say, oh, wow, she is fine. Okay? Or you may see a car drive by and it's like, oh, wow, look at the lines on that car. And 99 out of 100, that is sharp.
See, the problem is...
I want to get to this now, because we got to get to this next segment. Can truth only be ethical? Can it be aesthetic? What do you think, Professor, of analytical philosophy?
I'm friendly to the idea that there's an aesthetic dimension to truth. And part of it has to do with the fact that I think that ethical phenomena have an aesthetic quality as well. There's something, I mean, going all the way back to Plato, there's this idea that the true, the good, and the beautiful are among the highest values in reality, and that they all come together at the deepest levels of reality.
The true, the good, and the beautiful.
That's right.
Okay.
And I think there is something to this, and I think that even in mundane cases of truth-telling, there's something satisfying and right about truth-telling, in usual cases at least, where, you know, if you contrast this with a case where you get an untruth or a lie, there's something jarring about that, something that is unsettling, and I attribute this to an aesthetic dimension to the moral value of telling the truth.
Okay, aesthetics and morality. I got about 1 minute left in this segment. Damon, I'm going to come to you. Because when you tell a joke, there are the words coming out of your mouth,
right?
But there is the audience reacting to that story that you're telling. Mm-hmm. But there's this aesthetic quality that Damon Williams has to have as a comedian to make sure that people, get it, understand it, and are tickled by it.
Not only that, they have to believe it.
Ooh. Explain.
So if I tell a story about an aunt or an uncle who was at a funeral and did something crazy, for that joke to work, they have to believe that that actually happened, when in fact I made that up.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It could be a completely hypothetical situation, but my delivery has to be such that it makes it believable.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about what you do, and I believe that being a professional athlete is very difficult. I believe that being a scholar and a lawyer is difficult. But I believe probably deep in my heart that comedians probably have the hardest profession out there. Of course, that's relative.
Yeah.
But to stand in front of an audience with a microphone and make people laugh, that's a high art form. We're going to get back to that a little bit later,
okay,
as we talk about aesthetics and ethics in truth. Let's talk about fact and truth. Stanley Robertson brought it up earlier. And many times you can have a fact, but you can present several facts, but still not be telling the truth. How can that be? How can I be asked the question, I deliver facts, but I'm still not telling truth? Damon Williams, talk to me, man.
Well, first you have to start by running for president. Then you have to win the presidency. Then you have to get a spokesperson who backs up your lies. And you have to get another person to do that as well. That's my opinion.
That's your opinion?
Yes.
Professor Preston, you could tell 10 facts and still not be telling the truth. How can that be?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what kind of case you have in mind, because in one very straightforward sense, you are telling the truth when you're stating facts. And in one very straightforward sense, telling the truth just is a matter of stating facts. But of course, you can tell partial truths that, in virtue of being partial, are misleading. And so even though you are on one level telling truth, you are using that truth to cast misinformation and therefore lie.
I think it still goes back to a point that I made earlier, that a fact is not necessarily the truth if it's taken out of context.
Uh-huh.
If you state a fact, that doesn't mean that you're telling the truth. Truth is
so you're saying, that, so you're saying that the truth is greater than a fact? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, truth is all there is. There's nothing higher
than
truth.
The truth. So is a truth somewhat of an ethereal, empirical construct, whereas a fact is something that human beings just spout to prove a point that may be material?
I mean, that's possible.
Is a truth immaterial and a fact material? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that a fact is something that exists, that we can kind of assume that we can universally agree on something.
Whereas the truth is different from that?
The fact is a universal truth, except that the truth means when you state the fact, you are responding to the question at
uh-huh.
hand.
So in court, you're a lawyer. In court, the truth, the whole truth, and what?
Nothing but the truth.
Why in God's name do you have to have three forms of the truth to make sure that the person isn't lying on the stand?
Well, if you're in court, not telling the truth causes you to go to jail. That's called perjury. But if you are telling me something, even if you're stating a fact, if I ask you a question and I'm looking for a particular piece of information. Mm-hmm. Our conversation goes one way. And then you're stating something which may be a fact, but it's something not related to what I'm asking you. That fact actually is a lie because it's misleading.
Okay, so is this and we don't have to focus on, you know, certain politicians, but is that the flaw or is that the allegory of the cave when it comes to politics? I mean, if you enter politics, tell me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, you know that you have to compromise quite a bit. For one, your life is exposed because you're no longer a private citizen. You're public now. The second thing is you have to please entities according to the demographic. That's a little frustrating. That almost already just sets up lies, you know. Let's look at current politics. What do we do if someone's not telling the truth? What should we do as a tax-paying citizen if someone's not telling the truth? Damon Williams.
Well, in the current circumstance, first you pray. Because this is a lot going on right now, man. But more so, there should be a mechanism in place that can pull away a person that is not telling the truth continuously, especially if it's detrimental to the outcome of what their job is and what the people demand. Because we are their bosses. We forget that a lot of times. So say impeach if you want to go that route, or you know, follow up with your congressperson or whatever. But there's mechanisms in place, allegedly, to correct that.
Because if you're not telling the truth and telling good jokes, hold on. If you're not telling the truth and telling good jokes, you're going to get impeached by getting booed off the stage.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Well, if the falsehood that I'm telling is not funny.
And in the comedic world, funny is the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You brought that back. I see what you did
there. Yeah. In the professorial world, if you're not publishing enough peer-reviewed papers, other people outside are going to say, Aaron Preston, he's not the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not tenure capable. You know, if you're a lawyer and you're losing every case, you're not the truth, even though you may be telling the truth. So you had a comment, Stanley.
You mentioned the president. There is no law against lying.
Mm-hmm.
The president can lie all he wants. And in fact, he lies a lot. They've done a study that said that the president lies 70%
Should your
of the
doctor
time.
Lie to you? Should your doctor lie to you?
Your doctor should not lie. The president should not lie.
Absolutely.
Look, the president should not lie. I'm just saying that there's no law against lying.
But should there be consequences?
If I lie to my wife...
There are
consequences to the president lying. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that there's no law against it. There are consequences, and we're gonna see the consequences pretty soon. Now, unless he's lying under oath, if you're in the court of law and you lie under oath, now that's perjury. That's an impeachable offense.
But what do we tell children?
There's things that can happen.
Don't we tell children to be truthful? What good are we as adults if we're not bringing the truth and modeling the truth to a society that cannot stand if it doesn't have the truth, Professor?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, the legal system serves a very specific purpose in our world, but it does not serve the purpose of morality all the time. And there are bigger moral concerns at stake here. And, you know, it is a problem when the president lies. I think we all agree about that. And you asked initially, what do we do when someone like this is lying? And the answer is you call him out.
Mm. Right. Yes, I agree. I think you called him out. And I think that as far as the truth goes, the truth, in my mind, is a spiritual concept.
Okay.
Because I think that each person, our reality is inside us, because the only thing we can see of the world is our perception of the world. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the allegory of the cave.
We're going there.
Exactly, because in the allegory of the cave, the idea is that these people, they look at these images on the wall, mm-hmm. and those images are their reality.
Right. They're seeing shadows, right?
Right. It's a shadow.
Slaves chained to a wall, just going to give people the analogy quickly, chained to a wall, have never been outside of the cave. Sunlight comes into the cave. You start holding up cutouts of things that are in reality, but it's not the thing itself.
Let's say a lion.
A lion, a tiger, and then they believe that they believe that the reflection is the actual reality. Analytic philosophy, talk to me.
Yes, so not to pull rank, but I know a thing or two about the allegory of the cave.
A little bit.
and Plato's point in telling this story is not merely to illustrate the fact that we're all initially bound to our own unique perspective on the world. The point of the story is that we can transcend that perspective. The point of the story is that we need not remain chained in the cave looking at shadows, but that through the use of our minds, we can escape the cave and come to see reality as it is.
And I agree with Plato on that on that point. And that's why our idea, our perspective of truth is on the inside of us. Those guys who saw the shadows on the wall, they thought that that was real.
Uh-huh.
And it was real at that moment.
At that moment.
But when they left the cave, they discovered that there was another reality.
So
both of those things were real to those guys.
So if we continue to think that something is real in that moment, and we continue to think that even though we may know otherwise, is that always deleterious or detrimental?
Knowing otherwise is the problem. Okay. If you know otherwise, now it's a lie.
Okay, but
the fact that they didn't know otherwise made it real to them.
Now, when I go to see Damon Williams, I know that my universe is going to be altered because I may have had a bad day that day.
Okay.
But why do I come see you, Damon? Why do I come to your show?
Well,
what's the reason of your audience comes to see you?
I think it's an escapism to get away from what their truth is for that day, for what their life, their mundane situation, their day-to-day activities, or whatever situation they're going through. Or they're in a celebratory mood, and they want to take it to another level and be even more joyful. So my point and my position is to just provide the laughter and the humor based on what my perspective is of what I think the audience needs.
And you have a very strong way of creating allegory, if you ever see them. It's allegory. Your storytelling skills are on a totally distant level. I just love the way you present and your facial expressions. We can go on and on.
Thanks, man.
Let's talk about reality distortion field. I'm running out of time,
okay.
But reality distortion field. Steve Jobs was accused of having an RDF, all right, where something that hasn't happened, you say, I'm going to make it happen. And then you get a team around you to make it happen.
Okay.
Steve Jobs was notorious for this at Apple. He was like, make the iPod smaller, make the iPhone thinner. His engineers are like, we can't do this, man. We've crammed a computer inside this phone. We can't do. He's like, reality distortion field. Make it happen. I only got 2 minutes, gentlemen. You gotta act quick. Do you believe that there are reality distortion? Do you believe that reality distortion field is a truth?
Well, absolutely it is. Because what Steve Jobs was doing is he was using the notion that the thing inside of you can manifest itself in the real world if you just believe that it can.
Even if it doesn't exist.
It don't exist now, but you can make that happen. Everything that comes into existence did not exist until someone brought it into existence.
Architects, they say that a building is created three times. First in the mind, second the blueprint, third the actual building. I got about 1 minute. Reality distortion field, does it exist, Professor?
As a psychological reality, it does, but I do think it's a misnomer. It's not really distorting reality. I mean, Steve Jobs and his engineers were finding out more about what was really out there already, certain possibilities latent in the physical structures of the universe.
Yeah.
They were already there. He just helped them to believe that and to find it to be true.
Yeah. Damon Williams, I'm going to end with you. There was a time when you weren't a comedian.
Right.
You became a comedian.
Right.
Reality distortion field. When did you know, man? Were you in bed? Were you in front of a stage? When did you know that this is what I do?
I mean, I literally said it out loud. I said to my mother, this is what I plan to do. It was a gig I had for her office party. And after they laughed so well, I was like, I do now believe that this is what I'm going to do and this is what I will become.
And that's the truth.
Yeah.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore PBS. Going along with Monday evening's community conversation on voter involvement and politics, it was held at Purdue University Northwest Campus in Hammond. Voting rights groups say that Hoosiers could be improperly thrown off Indiana's voter rolls under a bill that is set to take effect next month. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that the change comes as the state checks its voter lists every year against the registration records from around the country.
Indiana uses what's called the Interstate Voter Registration Cross-Check each year. It looks for voters who move to another state. New legislation makes it easier for counties to remove voters they find in that system. Counties must first check whether a voter registered in another state is the same one registered in Indiana. The county can then remove that voter from the rolls if the registration in the other state happened after their Indiana registration. But the Brennan Center for Justice says there's a couple problems with that. Brennan Center counsel Jonathan Brader says the interstate cross-check system has produced troubling results in other states.
When Virginia used the list to remove voters in 2013, error rates as high as 17% were found.
And Brader adds states can't remove voters from their rolls based on a check like that alone.
The state still is required under federal law to contact the voter, give the voter the opportunity to respond.
Brader says he's hopeful the state will work with the Brennan Center to ensure no voters are wrongfully deleted from the rolls. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Indiana may not join the next wave of states that legalize medical or recreational marijuana, but it doesn't mean that Hoosiers can't partake in the booming business. That was the message from National Marijuana Business Association founder Dave Rines at a forum that was held in Indianapolis on Tuesday night. In a cigar-smoke-filled room at a downtown social club, he told a small crowd that other states' startup marijuana sectors need lawyers, marketers, investors, and agri-tech experts to get involved.
What I would suggest to you is you do not have to be a farmer to be a part of the cannabis and hemp revolution. You do not have to touch the plant. That these small and medium businesses, they need money, but they need more than that, your experience as professionals.
Ryans also says that Indiana's vaping regulations and the legalization of THC oil for seizure patients could be gateways to legalization here in this state. Opponents of marijuana access say that's not true. For people like Jeff Staker, the issue is one of life and death. Staker founded the nonprofit Hoosier Veterans for Medical Cannabis. He says that medical marijuana would reduce opioid abuse and overdoses among ailing military veterans like him.
Because if we don't do anything, each day more veterans are going to die. And there's obviously the civilians are dying too. But who is that voice that our politicians seem to be listening to, or who gets their attention? Unfortunately, it's us veterans.
Staker says that he invited Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill to speak at Tuesday's forum, but Hill declined. The Attorney General recently wrote an op-ed piece that appeared in the Indianapolis Star to warn against medical marijuana legislation and legalization. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we'll get reporters from the local media to talk about the big stories in Northwest Indiana of the week. We hope you'll join us for that tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking.